Welcome to another of WN Legal's podcasts. I'm Q. I'm the host for this podcast today. Together with me, I have Karen. He's my business partner.
Good afternoon.
I have Amy and I've got Karis, the two other lawyers.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. So today's topic for the podcast, we'll be talking a little bit about pre-action procedure stage in family court proceedings. Some of the issues that we will be dealing with or we usually deal with. This is going to be a very conversational podcast and we'll be discussing some of these issues, including but not limited to what needs to be disclosed by the parties during separation and during divorce or property proceedings. Any spendings post-separation between the parties? What happens if assets are hidden or, they are overseas and not declared? And excessive spendings during relationship, the contribution aspects of the parties during or post-separation, and subpoena or forensic subpoena of documents and forensic accounting issues that we would come across.
Generally, when you're looking at what documents need to be disclosed in family court proceedings, whether it be during court proceedings or in negotiation phases, the family law rules set out what documents need to be disclosed. Generally, it's bank statements for the past 3 years. That can be varied depending if there are other bank statements in previous years that will be relevant. Pay slips, income tax assessments, BAS statements for your companies. Basically, you need to establish what the actual asset pool marital
the full financial climate of the parties, is that right?
Yeah, including the superannuation as well. The last statement as well.
Will they be part of the disclosure in de facto?
It is required, so you do still have to disclose your superannuation if you are in a de facto relationship, but as opposed to it being considered part of the asset pool, not so much for de facto. However, it will come into play, I suppose, when you're dealing with the future needs aspects of one party and the financial resources of that party as well.
Yes,
if one party
yes.
has $100,000 in super as opposed to maybe not so much for the other person, then that will get taken into account. But if you're de facto, you can't necessarily, you can't do a super split in WA unless you're married.
I think you also need to disclose gifts, any testamentary dispositions, although they are inherited to yourself. I think you need to look as well.
In terms of what we're trying to set out to the public today, we're trying to establish what is the asset pool. So that's the first step. What the court actually needs to determine as in the first step of proceedings is to determine what is the asset pool.
Yes. So apart from that, I think asset is not really the proper term because liabilities is also something that they would have to establish.
Well, that's right. They look at the net asset pool. So basically putting all of your assets into one big pile and then deducting off your liabilities and then what net are you left with at the end of that,
I suppose,
is how you determine it.
Yep.
And
so
then,
that comes to the second point, which is spending after separation or during separation, contributions or negative contributions of the parties.
I suppose in respect to negative contributions, or maybe firstly we'll start with the actual financial contributions, but this is income, this is, so this is income, any sort of gift or inheritance, large lump sums, any lotto wins, anything like that. So so who's contributed the most in terms of the financial contributions?
Yes. And the issues, the difficulties we deal with in this practice when we deal with post-separation is a lot of our clients ask us and tell us about the diamond ring that, the other party spends on, and it's not a wedding ring, it's not an engagement ring. They just went out there and bought a very expensive ring. So, Karen, what's your opinion on that spending aspect of things? If post-separation, if there is such a huge spending, how does that affect the contribution of the parties?
Well, often the problem is people tend to spend money after the relationship and, intentionally deplete the asset pool of the relationship by buying a new car and heavily financing that vehicle. The problem with that is that they fail to take into account that one of the main things the court takes into account when determining the split between the parties is the conduct of the parties. and also they make adjustments for negative contributions. So when one party intentionally does something to deplete the asset pool, the court will actually make an adjustment in the asset pool, you know, to account for that action that was taken. It's imperative that people take that into account when, you know, it's important that you receive legal advice before, you know, making any drastic changes, even if it occurs after separation.
I think the issue here is not whether it's unnecessary spending, it's spending that is more malicious, if I could put it that way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I like shopping.
Yeah, I mean, unnecessary spending during the course of a relationship is very hard to do anything about.
That's correct.
You know, and from, I suppose, previous experience in the family court, they don't really...
Yeah.
You know, it's very difficult to calculate how much someone has spent during the course of a marriage.
Yeah.
You know, who's to say what is reasonable and what's unreasonable, really.
Case in point. I like shopping. Doesn't mean that, you know, every single cent I spend.
You like push bikes as well.
Yes, I do. But that
face cream.
But that doesn't mean that it becomes a negative contribution. It needs to be, for example, drug habit. Going out there and striking deals that are unnecessary. Say if me and my partner were in a relationship, and then she goes out there and she decides to invest, 50% of the asset pool into a business that she hasn't told me, and then all's gone. That's probably something that the court will seriously consider.
And I think, unfortunately, in today's day and age, you know, there is a lot of negative contributions in relation to drug use as well. You know,
and
given
gambling
given the prevalence of that in today's society, so that's a big one that comes into it, most definitely.
That would ultimately tip the scale or the balance of the contribution of the parties and who is to get what at the end of the day. So it's something that should be really seriously considered.
I think just thinking of it from a commonsensical point of view. You know, if someone is spending maybe $300,000 in a, you know, to sustain a drug addiction during the relationship, that's money that could have been put towards a mortgage or something. So the court does take that into account, you know, when determining people's entitlements.
Well, obviously, that's something people don't just simply disclose. Back to point one, something that will be brought up as an issue when we negotiate or where we make submissions in court in respect to parties' proceedings and what asset split is necessary.
Well, I might direct a question at Kyron in relation to hidden assets and how we go about getting disclosure on assets that are overseas or that someone is intentionally trying to hide, which is notoriously quite difficult, and there's a lot of things that you need to weigh up before you can actually... not before you can actually do that, but before you should do that. There's a lot of things that should be taken into account first. So, Kyron, what sort of things or searches can we do in order to find possible assets that are overseas or hidden?
I think that this is tailored towards people's specific legal situations. So, you know, always obtain legal advice where you can, please, before making a decision. In respect to hidden assets, maybe, or monies that have been utilized or excessively spent during a relationship, you know, we would actually get the bank statements from the other party and, you know, do a full investigation to find out whether there have been excessive withdrawals and then seek justification for those type of withdrawals. When you're talking about overseas assets that maybe some parties have, it's difficult to obtain, you know, information in relation to certain jurisdictions, because, you know, it's just the reality that some jurisdictions don't hold a central title deeds office like in Australia. You know, and often they siphon out their properties to family members, of which you probably won't even know who they are. So, you know, that's something that needs to be considered. If it's in a jurisdiction that, you know, there is a central deeds office, then we could do property searches, obviously, and maybe get lawyers over there to assist us in obtaining that type of information.
I guess the triggering fact, well, you need to find what in the past in our practice, we realize things are a bit different through looking at simple thing, a bank statement. You actually see, well, we did see money going out by, 10,000 a week, some of them you know, a lot more a day and day by day basis. And the money just go out to bank accounts that are not referred to by the parties. So I guess it requires a more keen eye to in looking at bank statements to determine whether there are overseas ties, not specifically hidden assets, because we don't sometimes really know whether they are assets that they purchased. It's just money that's going out and that's not declared and not mentioned by the parties.
And as Kyron said earlier in relation to each person's circumstances, you know, that you should get legal advice, this is where it's quite imperative, because to do these overseas searches and to try and find assets that are possibly overseas is very expensive, and you've got to weigh up the costs of doing that as opposed to potentially, I suppose, what you're going to find. If you've got quite a large asset pool, then maybe you can justify the costs associated with doing that. But if the asset pool is nil, nominal, or you know, in or about that amount, then the cost benefit of doing that is just probably just not there. It's just not worth it. You know, you could spend tens of thousands of dollars and come up with a few dollars, which at the end of the day, is just not feasible.
We must also make it clear that, so if, for example, if the parties have an estimated gross asset pool of, what, say, $3 million, say, and if you realize that the asset found overseas is more than $2 million, for example, then we're talking about a wholly different jurisdiction where the matter needs to continue or proceed with. It's the Supreme Court, not no longer the family court. So those are the issues you also need to consider at the end. Now, that comes to the fourth point, which is excessive spending during a relationship. It ties in with the second point of spending after a relationship, but this is during the relationship. I think we covered a bit about drug use during the relationship previously. And I'm sure there's other issues that that are prevalent that occurs during the relationship that the parties can easily identify. Usually, more so than not, it comes down to our clients telling us what they believe is excessive spending. Obviously, we won't be going through every single itinerary through the list to determine what is excessive and not. It needs to be very, very prevalent. There are some incidences where the business accounts have been utilized as a module to siphon money out. There are some instances where it's personal accounts. Some instances we had from trusts. And so there are many more. The same issue comes out to finding the trigger, finding the point where the money exits.
And I think that's a really subjective you know, position as well. You know, my idea of what is excessive, you know, I would consider Q's spending on his bicycle quite excessive, but then exactly. Q would also probably think my spending on handbags or shoes is excessive, but to me it's not, and to him it's not. So it's it's a hard one, that, you know, actually putting that into practical
just think about, Amy, when you bring that up, I just think about a recent court hearing that I heard before I went up in one of my own, where the party was seeking disclosure or statements about, I think it was 6 or 7 years worth for nominal amounts spent on beauty products, and the court was absolutely blasting, you know, the other party for seeking something of that nature, because obviously when you're earning money, you know, you need to spend on your living, and each person's got a different threshold.
Sorry,
I need my shoes to survive, guys.
But the case in point that what Kara is trying to bring up is, if in the past five years you spend on beauty products, say $200,000, and yes, that's quite a bit, but 5 years worth of it, and beauty products can range from simple nail polish all the way to full fledged
very expensive creams.
So therein lies the difference. If we are talking about something that petty, that's a different story. We need to be talking about drug use. We need to be talking about money laundering schemes, or gambling. Money
prostitution
going out.
Even.
Yep.
You know, prostitution is another one as well.
But,
using of prostitutes.
But we have to be careful. We have to draw the line between whether using it is unethical It actually needs to be the issue of excessive spending.
Yeah.
That's what can be proven.
What can be proven is very important, because you can see large withdrawals, but if you can't prove otherwise, then you know it's not going to point in the direction of that was spent on that particular habit.
Yes, that brings us to the next issue, which is subpoenas. So, look, long story short, is once you found the trigger or where the money's gone, and then you need to start finding out what's happening there. And subpoenas are your best friend and your enemy at the same time, because it clearly, you know, eliminates all doubt. But be very sure as to what you're subpoenaing, because all documents subpoenaed will be made available to every single party in the proceedings, and they will be held in court, in obviously a specific storage. But subpoenas,
I think the moral of the story is don't subpoena something if you're not really entirely sure about what you're going to pull up. Because it can either work really well or blow up in your face. I suppose.
But it's a very good reality check.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an extremely important reality check, because if you're going in there and go, oh wait, she spent so much money on this thing and it turns out to be nothing. The test is, what if I subpoena it? Will it look bad on me or will it not? And I mean, the conduct of the parties will be heavily scrutinized at the time of the trial, depending on obviously how they maneuver through their legal proceedings. It's a very, very careful step and process. And Karen, I know, does take into consideration all these things before doing so. And obviously our practice, we have discussions about these issues from time to time. And we apply them in our case.
And I suppose when it's appropriate to subpoena and
who and
when.
Now, next question, Karen or Karis, forensic accounting. When is the time when we consider them? And how? That's another very interesting issue, isn't it?
Yeah. Because again, I think again with that, it's that
cost benefit,
analysis again, because that again is extremely expensive. So whilst that's a good way of going about resolving any doubts that you might have about what is in an asset pool or where money might be going, it's also can be a fruitless search as well.
I guess don't get us wrong. Forensic accounting doesn't mean that we are looking at the full ledgers of the books and deciding. You know, it can very well be a valuation of a company's worth. The bookkeeping aspect of things. And from there we can tell there's most of the time during separation, a lot of people will have difference in opinion of the value of a company that the other party holds.
Yeah, definitely.
Or the ex-partner holds.
Yeah.
And forensic accounting and subpoenas, they are part and parcel of obviously what we do, but the issue is whether it's feasible and practical to use them. I think before we even go there to the fifth point, we have to consider all previous 4 points with extreme care and make a decision accordingly before we decide to subpoena or scrutinize or hire a third party to scrutinize the intrinsics of any books.
I mean, if you've got a business value, you know, where there's goodwill of maybe $50,000, just doing a business valuation on that will probably be $10,000, you know, for a normal business from what I've seen recently. So it's definitely a cost-benefit analysis, especially when you're dealing with sole trader businesses and that type of thing. So, you know, but that, be mindful of that. You need to find guidance. And again, you know, if you need to seek legal advice, then, you know, that's what you should do before making any drastic movements, especially if you're representing yourself in family courts.
Yes. A lot of the time, I find that self-reps, they tend to obviously pull the necessary, what I would deem it as red flags, to canvas issues. But the problem of going in there and making an application to subpoena documents, to review certain things, to look into an account intrinsically, they are time-consuming, wasting the court's time if it's not relevant. Those are issues that needs to be dealt with very, very carefully by all the parties before the matter proceeds, specifically to trial.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. Okay, well, I think that wraps it up for today. I don't know if anyone's got anything further to say. I think Kyron, you're good over there?
Well, no, we've dealt with that's the first step in property proceedings, so I think we'll probably do a full episode podcast, so to speak, you know, in, you know, what's involved in determining property entitlements. And today was, you know, determining what is the asset pool of the relationship. So we'll take it from there.
Right, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.